So, Bill, I'll let you go first. If you could read chapter 5, verses 7 through 9.
7 through 9, and this is from the Free Bible Version.
Okay.
Friends, be patient as you wait for the Lord's return. Think of the farmer waiting patiently for the earth's precious harvest as it grows with the early and later rains. You need to be patient too. Stay strong, for the Lord's return is near. My friends, don't complain about each other so you won't be judged. Look, the judge is standing right at the door.
This is interesting, because doesn't he earlier say don't judge?
I don't remember here. I was just thinking, though, don't judge did come across my desk in multiple forms out of the Gospels.
You know, it seems seems to me I remember reading a specific verse where he says not to, to judge. But I could be wrong. Maybe I read that into it. It seems to me it was like on the exposition of the tongue. But I don't see it.
Well, there's don't speak badly, James 4:11. Anyone who criticizes a fellow believer and condemns them, criticizing condemns the law. If you condemn the law, you're not someone who keeps the law.
There's the law, but a judge over it. There's only one lawgiver. And yeah, but you who judge your neighbor, who are you? Yeah.
So he's reiterating this. He's coming back and saying, really, don't judge.
Yeah. Don't complain about each other, brothers and sisters. If that were followed by the church, what a transformation that would be.
Yeah. Well, it speaks to me again, because, you know, there are those who make it really hard sometimes to just be fully accepting because they're critical.
Mm-hmm.
And when I meet highly critical people, as nice as they may be, they're critical about whatever their pet thing is. And I have to wonder, am I like this too? That a person is simply wrong. I mean, take coronavirus, take vaccines, take this, take theology and theological preferences. You know, and I'm going to just say it that way, is we each have a way we think. And what we think makes the most sense to us. And so therefore it is our truth. And if it's true for me, then it should be true for you. And if it's not, you're wrong. And then the critical person or the strength of that perspective gets applied broadly. And I think that is a form of judgment that becomes, well, problematic. It's one thing to distinguish, discern, as judgment, like I can judge that there are differences of opinion. That's discernment for me. But judging seems to be this connotation of condemnation rather than a discernment of difference. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, when we condemn and criticize, we don't learn anything.
So if James is saying, be patient. Don't complain about each other.
I'll never forget on a Friday evening, my neighbor, my female neighbor, there was a couple live next door to me. And so the wife invited me over for an evening supper. And her husband, I guess, invited over a friend who was also a teacher at PUC. At that time, I was not teaching yet, except contract teaching. The man that he invited just blew smoke into the air with criticizing and condemning and just everything in the book had to do with the college. Just fuming and fussing and whining. And it was so bad and so black that, and I mean black as in dark, so dark that I ate my meal, which was light, said a few words to the woman, and excused myself. I just couldn't stick around.
Were you done with your thought?
Yes, I'm done.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I don't want to preach a sermon on that one.
Well, no. So part of what it strikes me is that there are, I'm going to reference Cloud and Townsend, the boundary guys. They write all the boundaries books. Boundaries in marriage, boundaries in dating, boundaries, how people grow. Anyway, for us to grow, there are healthy interactions and unhealthy interactions. And if highly critical people are present and we recognize I can't grow in that, then I can easily say, well, it's not judgment. You're free. And I pray for your happiness and your peace and your contentment. It drags me down. So that's discernment, not judgment. As a way for me to distinguish that. On the other hand, if my reaction is, wow, they're going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
I see that now my approach to them will be different. And now I am as condemnatory as I've experienced them to be. Maybe different in expression, but
yeah,
so that's how I'm trying to distinguish.
Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking at that time. I was pretty disturbed, I think. And I think I was mostly disturbed at where it would lead.
Well, and this is how I've met people who are, and again, I have to ask myself, is it the way I am? And I'm still answering that question, but highly critical people who always are telling other people are wrong, not just different, but wrong. And it's like, well, I have this friend, but they're wrong. And then they can pontificate on whatever it is that they're wrong about. And I'm thinking, am I this person's friend? Because it kind of sucks to be their friend. I'd rather not be their friend and be wrong than be their friend and just always be wrong in their eyes. How can we learn and grow? And this comes back to judgment seems to inhibit growth.
I like how you distinguish sympathy from empathy. You can't have sympathy with people because you can't imbibe in what they're doing. But you can't empathize with them. And you've pointed me a way out. And that was something I lacked that afternoon. I just was like, get me out of here. You know, I had a very strong negative reaction. But I think with this woman whose letter I talked about, I haven't known what to say. But I think you've pointed me a way forward. If I empathize with her about not knowing who's telling the truth, that's a terrible position to be in. That's horrible. And maybe offer, have you prayed about this? Asking God to show you. I don't know. But I think empathizing with her at first, at least, is the way to start.
What are the, I mean, James is nothing if not practical, right? So taming the tongue, if we go back far enough in James, is not, let's say he's anti-judgment, he's saying, hey, God's the judge. If we're going to be, you know, let him, and I've seen this throughout scripture, if you want to think about God a certain way, let him be the judge. And elsewhere, we might find even God isn't the judge. It might be we are our own judge. I don't know. But the idea that he doesn't want us judging each other because judging isn't empathetic.
No, it's the opposite.
It's the opposite. If love is being expressed through our relationship by faith, by trust, by relationship, I'm going to demonstrate, and I think this is true for James, I'm going to allow that relationship to flow. I love because God first loved me.
Right.
I don't love apart from that. So if I'm taking bits of this, now love doesn't judge the other.
Right.
So the taming of the tongue, the allowing your faith to be demonstrated by your works, James's words, I think, all of that is expressed love, love in action. Well, this is consistent with the gospel in general, certainly. So in when we meet the difficult people, when we're the difficult person, what do we want? We want kindness, empathy, even if people don't agree. Isn't there somewhere a kind answer turns away wrath? Is that Proverbs?
No, kind answer turns away wrath. I think it's Paul.
Oh, okay.
Cruel words. Oh, wait a minute. It is in Proverbs. I think it's also in Paul in a different way. Kind words turn away wrath, but what is it? Something stirs up anger. Cruel words stir up anger, I think.
And of course, it all depends on what version you're reading. So, Proverbs 16, kind words are like a honeycomb. They taste sweet and are healthy for the body.
That's one verse, but there's another one that says cruel words stir up anger.
Kind reply wards off anger, but hurtful words make people mad. Proverbs 15:1.
Right. That's the one I was thinking of. I think James could be considered the wisdom literature of the New Testament.
It does have that ring to it, to me.
Yeah. Okay. Now,
let me ask this. What was James's understanding about waiting for the Lord's return? Now he's giving us the illustration of a farmer waiting patiently for the harvest, and he knows that there's a process and a time of sowing to a time of reaping. Mm-hmm. Did James have an understanding? I mean, it seemed like the gospel writers thought it would be in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm. I think they always did. I think Ellen White thought it would be in her lifetime. I think that that's appropriate, which, again, this absolutism falls apart when you're talking about the second coming. When is it
coming? It is an example, yeah,
of the problem. When is it coming? And there's no good answer to that. That's forever. I have my lifetime.
That's all I have.
It is in our lifetime. Yeah. But we don't let it keep us from doing what we need to do here and now.
And so now I have I'm good with all that. Now I have the additional question, stay strong for the Lord's, the early and the latter rains. Is this, he's just talking about what we know of the farming in Cameroon. You planted at the first rain and then you would have a later rain that really produced nourishment.
That's the way it is in Palestine, I believe.
And he's not talking prophetically about the latter rain.
I don't know whether he is or not. And this is where in Jewish writing you can get more than one meaning from something.
Okay, I won't be absolute about this then.
I don't think he'd go through that process if he didn't say there's a process that has to happen before Jesus comes. So looking at that process, we know Jesus coming is near.
That's what he's saying you need to be patient too, just like the farmer, stay strong for his return is near, because he has seen an early in his own life, a latter rain. Even if it isn't the latter rain.
He's seen the early rain, at least. Okay. The early rain would have been Pentecost. I don't see anywhere in New Testament writings that there was something equivalent to that as a latter rain.
Okay. So they were always looking forward towards something that would evidence itself like that.
And that would show that the end is near and Jesus is coming soon.
Okay. Right. Sorry, I saw that and it triggered those wonderings in my head. And so as a Hebrew writer, he's writing multi-layered and allowing flexibility within that?
In certain places. In some places, he's very straightforward and it is what it is.
Okay. All right.
So are we ready for 10 to 11?
Well, before we, now let me just go back and say, okay, so we answered, I think, pretty well, don't be a judge. When he says, look, the judge is standing right at the door, is that because the Lord is near and the Lord is the judge?
I would take it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, I would take it that way.
Yes, then you've answered my question.
Because I think, you know, and I don't know how much he reflects on the Gospels, because the Gospels, when James was writing, are probably still oral, pretty much.
Oh.
I'm assuming James is early. I could be wrong. He's writing to the 12 tribes.
So Matthew, Mark, Luke, certainly John's Gospel came much later.
Right.
Who is, so, was Mark the first one?
There's this parable of Jesus that comes to my mind anyway with what he says about not judging, not complaining, because the judge is at the door. And I don't know if I can write offhand, find it. But it's where Jesus says, talks in a parable about the man who's in charge going away. And while he's gone, his servants start fighting and quarreling among themselves.
That strikes me as being Matthew, but I couldn't swear to it.
It could be in Matthew because I've read it often enough. I'm more familiar with, let's put it this way, Matthew is an MT, and I'm more familiar with Matthew and structurally. I can't find anything in Luke. You know, Luke is just... I believe Luke.
He writes in his own order. See, I don't know. David Kiersey, in his work on personality, put John as an NF, Mark as the SP.
Mm-hmm.
I think he put Luke as the NT and Matthew as the SJ. But that's just off my own thinking. I don't remember.
And that's just funny because I have David Kiersey's temperament, but I would never put Matthew as an SJ and Luke as a NT.
Okay.
I see Luke as trying to set out history of Jesus. And he does research and he puts it all together. And that does sound very NT, but it also sounds very SJ. And whereas Matthew has a certain structure of the covenant that he has, in which he fits everything together.
Yeah.
I don't know. I may be wrong, but you know, when it comes to temperament types, that's where we have to be the most adaptive.
Well, it's funny because when I read that most people think, if you know temperament and that sort of thing, Myers-Briggs, that John as an NF, it would relate, it makes sense that I would resonate with John as an NF and that it was the most readable gospel for me. So if you find Matthew the most readable and you are an NT, that may be the reason.
I don't know that I find it the most readable. I actually find John the most readable.
Oh, okay.
Because I love the way he portrays Jesus so differently.
Yeah.
From the other gospels and uses totally fresh stories that they never included.
Yeah.
Because it didn't fit their purpose. Let me see if I can find. I don't think I could find it.
Okay.
I don't want to waste any more time. But I do know it's in either Matthew or Luke. So are we ready for 10 yet?
Yeah.
Okay. Brothers and sisters, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of patient resolve and steadfastness. Look at how we honor those who practice endurance. You've heard of the endurance of Job, and you've seen what the Lord has accomplished, for the Lord is full of compassion and mercy. I like the word endurance here for Job, rather than patience.
Yeah, Free Bible has patience, but happy are those, notice that we say those who endure are blessed. And well, the word for
can mean to endure.
And Job did endure.
Job does not qualify as a patient man. At least in my reading of how he complains to God and says some pretty strong things.
And yet he did endure.
But he did endure. I agree with that.
And so, is it Paul add to your, you know, this, that, and the other thing, endurance, because it builds character, basically? To this, add that, and to that, add this. And
I think it's Peter.
Okay. I'm failing in my Bible connections, but, you know, it all blends together for me. When people ask me for my text to prove something, I'm like, I'm sorry, I have the whole thing. It's all connected, and I can't tease it apart into a string of 10 texts that makes sense. Anyway.
You're not into string theory. No.
Yeah, well, you know, string theory, here a little, there a little is what comes to mind. But I do find that there are things that we resonate with as our foundation. When I'm looking at these texts, not only is it happier those that endure or blessed, those who endure are blessed. I can't help but think of the Beatitudes is how I read that line. Happier those who. And the recasting, if you will, of patience from just a few verses above to endurance, then it's not just looking and saying, I'll be patient because I know there's a process, and I think there's room for that. But Job endured active persecution beyond what he understood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something, as we wait for the process to unfold, we encounter the arrows of the enemies or the wounds of life. Thinking about John Eldridge and a bunch of, you know, his stuff, we are wounded in life. And God is in the process of healing all of those wounds, but the enemy knows them well and wants to pour salt or lemon into those wounds.
Mm-hmm.
If you will, patient endurance for the healing that will come. Now, that's how, when he mentions and invokes Job, wow, that does.
I don't think Job, well, in his high moments, he had lows and highs. And yeah. In his high moments, he believed that my witness is in heaven and he who vouches for me is on high. And at one point, and this has been badly translated all through all Trent versions.
Now, refresh my mind. Was Job an active part of your dissertation?
He was my dissertation. You talk about yourself being holistic, Bill. I did the whole book. I wasn't going to do that at first. I was going to do a portion of Job, but I began to find more and more and more. You know the cycle. See, if you're a P, you are weak on the FT scale.
Yeah.
If you're a J, you're weak on the NS scale.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
That's according to Kiersey, the research that he did. And that makes so much sense in my life because there are times when I float between being an NT. I really am basically an NT. You know, at most points in my life, you'll find me to be an NT. But when it comes to writing, I float in between. And I'm very holistic.
Yeah.
I'm very holistic. But of course, I'm an INTP. And they are, that's a design temperament. That's
you have to see the design.
That's the architect. So we are holistic, you know, and that may be where it comes from. But anyway, no, I got criticized recently by a colleague who said, I've never heard of anybody doing the whole book of Job in a dissertation. Well,
forest in the tree.
My committee loved it.
Yeah.
I didn't say that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Job, it comes in Job 19. No, that's the other one. Job 15, I think it is. No, that's Eliphaz. Let's try 16.
I do like some of the questions Eliphaz asks.
You do? I must confess, I'm a bit prejudiced against Eliphaz.
I am suspicious of his worldview, but then were you born before the hills were created? Were you listening to God in the councils, in God's council? Does wisdom only belong to you? I think there are some honest questions from my reading, but I don't have the deep knowledge of Eliphaz that you do. So
I don't have a lot of deep knowledge about Eliphaz. I did not really do the whole book of Job, but I did I did Job, the person of Job, more in entirety.
Okay.
And the rest of it as I needed to. Yeah, 16:18-20. Earth, don't cover my blood. Let my outcry never cease. Surely now my witness stands in heaven. My advocate is on high. My go-between, my friend, while my eye drips tears to God. That's not what I was looking for. I'm going to try 13.
Although the witness in heaven, the one who speaks from
here,
on high.
Here it is, 13:13. Be quiet and I will speak, come what may. For what reason will I take my flesh and my teeth and put my life in jeopardy? And there's two ways to read the next line. Though he slays me, yet I will trust in him is the traditional King James Version. But most modern versions, he will slay me, I am without hope. And then the next line doesn't make any sense with that at all. I will surely prove my way to his face. So the way I translate it is, I will take my flesh in my teeth. It's not necessarily a question there. And I will put my life on the line. Though he slay me, I will wait for him, that I might prove my ways to his face.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, I'm the only one who's ever translated that way. It works beautifully with the Hebrew. If you take it as, there's a difference between what we call the written Hebrew and the vocal Hebrew, or the spoken Hebrew. And I don't remember which is which, but I take one of them that is more traditional, but I finesse it in context.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's very clear.
The book is written, but it's written in a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be elements of both present. I would be.
Yeah.
There
could be. You have to pick one or the other. Although I do in my translation make notes of alternatives.
Well, I like that. I mean, from the standpoint that, again, this comes up, what happens at the very end, the end of time? So end of the age, end of the next age. So if I understand correctly, Seventh-day Adventists don't look at the second coming as the end of the story. We look at the third coming as the end of the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may not be fully universally held within Adventism, but it's how I understand Seventh-day Adventists and my own beliefs of being an Adventist. The second coming is great news, but we go for 1,000 years of rest for a number of different purposes, potentially. But at the end of that, the New Jerusalem comes back to earth. There's an end of the rebellion in total. What happens to those who are continuously rebellious and are outside the kingdom? Does God execute them? Or what? And I'm not trying to answer that today. I'm just saying that sort of the Job language of, even if he kills me, I will trust him, or I will, how did you word it? Because that's new for me.
Word is not trust in Hebrew. It's actually to wait.
To wait.
It's been translated as trust, because if you look at waiting, it's an act of trust. So you can take by extended meaning. But the core meaning is wait. And so though he slay me, yet I will wait for him that I might defend my ways to his face.
So could that slaying, obviously,
I don't put slaying in. Oh, yeah.
Oh, what is
slaying? Though he slay me, yet I will wait for him. Yeah, that slang.
That would come at the end of it all.
Yeah.
I'm going to have my day. Well,
it's clear in Job that he believes in afterlife. Death is not the last word. So if he has to, he will wait until he's the resurrection.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There's other places where he talks about, intimates that there's an afterlife after death.
Okay. I was just thinking, even if the mindset is at the end of it all, I die, I know I will be heard. It was sort of the way I was rendering it, was not necessarily an afterlife, but that he could see that God would,
if he didn't
kill
say,
him.
I would have to settle for that if he hadn't said what he does. And I know that my Redeemer lives, and though worms destroyed my body, yet without my flesh, I shall see God.
Is that in Job or that's elsewhere?
That's Job.
Oh, it is. Okay. Wow. Okay.
My eyes shall behold him, not another's.
All right.
See, his ultimate goal, his great goal, is to see God face to face and just have it out with him.
Yeah.
Find out what on earth is happening.
Truly, what on earth is happening?
And God doesn't really tell him point blank that, you know, there's a Satan. At Job's time, there was no dualism like later developed. So Job would have had a hard time understanding that. So God talks in language Job can understand about Leviathan and Behemoth and the darkness and the deep and it's all cosmic conflict stuff in chapter 41, no, chapter 38 to 41.
God's speech to Job.
Yeah. God's speech. And that actually is my favorite chapter in the whole book. It's the one I've used the most, published the most, or presented the most, because that's where I wanted to focus on the most. Originally, I was going to do Leviathan. That was my goal. And I got canned by one of the professors in my dissertation committee, who was just adamantly opposed. You can't do that. You can't prove that the Satan is the Leviathan is the Satan. That is too conservative of you. And oh, he was drunk, you have to know. He came to my proposal committee meeting drunk and out of sorts. He didn't even have a copy that I had passed out at the end of my orals defense. I had passed out what I wanted to do in Job, and he didn't even have a copy of that. He acted like he'd never gotten one, never seen it. And the truth is, I handed him a copy, you know. So he must have put it in the circular file in anger, tore it up and shredded it. I don't know. Anyway, I couldn't have my way, and so I started looking for what I could do with it. And I started finding out that the book of Job is talking again vis-a-vis the ancient Near East, ancient Babylon. And that just opened up a whole vista. And I did intertextuality, which is a postmodern method.
Going to our earlier pre-recording conversation, yes. But how else do we actually triangulate if you only come from tried and true, approved, narrow? The postmodern allows you to take multiple views that aren't necessary. Anyway, I may be pontificating, so feel free to have that added to that. You were saying, I didn't want to interrupt that.
No, I was at a pause.
I was thinking again, because James and what he is saying is invoking Job. And did the Jewish tradition understand or think of Job as the oldest story? Or how did they?
You know, I haven't studied the rabbis on Job.
Okay.
That would mean looking at rabbinics, which I'm weak on.
I can't help but think, as a Hebrew writing sort of a Hebrew book, letter, and invoking the story of Job, if you will, patient endurance. That the conclusion of the Job story is how the Lord brought a positive conclusion because he's full of compassion and mercy. So that goes to those final chapters of Job. It goes to the overall narrative of the Old Testament and the revelation of God through Jesus. James is packing a lot in like two verses.
Yeah, this compassion and mercy strikes me as he's thinking of Job, because here Job just blasts God repeatedly. What do you do with that? And the overall question in Job is, there are several questions that are overarching in Job. And one of them is, did Job curse God? And there's two words for curse. One means to speak lightly of, to desecrate, to, you know, treat poorly, and so on. The other one means flat out to curse someone. May the ground you walk on split beneath your feet and bury you alive, you know. that's an example of a curse formula. Apparently, when Satan says he will curse you to your face, he uses, I believe, the word kalal, which means that lighter term. So it's easier to curse God in that kalal sense than in the arar sense. And so the question is raised, did Job curse God or not? Because let me say overarchingly what I found in the book.
Can you say what the arar one is again?
It's a flat out curse. May the ground swallow you up and bury you alive.
I see.
It's a very verbal curse. Whereas kalal is, you just simply misrepresent God, you've cursed him or something like that. The overarching thing of the book of Job is that there are two sides. You're in a conflict. There are two sides. And this also fits with Rachel Magdalene, whom I mentioned here before, her view that the book is a trial. You could fit it either way. But there are two sides. And on about Job, there's two views. And so when it comes to the end, it turns out that God exonerates Job, because he says to the three friends, you have not spoken of me what is right, like my servant Job has. And he tells them to do a hefty sacrifice.
So that clearly means Job didn't misrepresent God.
Is that the graciousness and compassion that James is talking about here, that God would do that? He doesn't say, Job, shame on you for all you said back here.
I'm thinking out loud. Job spoke of me, or maybe it was, well, the friends didn't speak well of God, so they cursed him because they misrepresented him.
But indirectly, yes. There's,
correct.
There's
not the
cursed him. Mm-hmm.
Not the invocation of a curse, but the misrepresentation type of curse.
What God says, I better go find it again. End of Job, there's a very specific term. It's the word folly. That you have not, that I not treat you according to your folly. So you have to sacrifice lest I treat you according to your folly.
Oh, that's to the friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So if we're looking at two different types of curses, and I just have these in my head, Job did neither one. His friends did a misrepresentation, and God is being not kind and merciful to Job. He's being kind and merciful to the friends.
You know, in a way you can say that, but I don't know that James is going that way. I kind of think he thought God was kind and merciful to Job because
he
didn't denounce him for cursing him, possibly. I maintain that God's exoneration meant that only the one cursed, quote, quote, cursed, can say whether they really have been cursed or not. And God says, no, I haven't. Job said to me what is right.
Well, so the question would be, did Job curse God? And I think that's a fine question. And God saying no, but God is revealing that his friends did, and that can be forgiven. On the other hand, and forgiven because that is who God is. And so that means we can be restored from our perspective. So there's the patient endurance of Job. Oh, you had mentioned that it can be seen as a legal case. Did I understand that right?
Or a judicial trial.
So I can't help but say, from Job's perspective and the accusations, it could be seen that way. But if you pull the curtain back a little bit, I mean, we even get it in the book of Job. Is it really about Job?
No.
Or is it about
God? And that's why at the end, this is the neat thing that I've only, you know, I didn't realize this when I wrote my dissertation at all. But only in recent years have I really come to realize that, you know, you start out with the book of whether Job is a righteous and upright man, right? That's the question. Somewhere along the book, Job transfers from trying to defend his righteousness, to defending what is righteousness. And God ends the book with not Job is an upright and perfect man, which he did at the beginning. He ends it with Job has said to me what is right. And that is the trajectory and journey that all of us need to take.
Well, this is why bearing false witness. We are witnesses. We're not on trial, but we feel like Job. We feel like we're on trial.
Oh, yeah.
And which is why then we interpret Paul and all these others in a certain way, because it makes us feel better as a legal thing, and that it's all been taken care of. And I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying, for me, this is where I've grown thinking. And instead, now I view it as I am caught up in this cosmic conflict where God is on trial and I'm a witness called. And the truth is, the adversary wants to assail my character as a poor witness.
Job is very clear on that. In fact, Rachel Magdalene in her dissertation says that an ancient Near Eastern, that is a Neo-Babylonian court trial, could include two defendants and two prosecutors.
Wow.
So who are the two in Job? And she believes that Job is the quintessential court trick case for the Neo-Babylonian period. So who are the two prosecutors? We'll start with them because they're hard, but one of them is hard, one of them is easy. Who are the accusers?
Well, there's the one prowling the earth saying, you know, he's only nice to you because you're nice to him.
Right. That's the Satan. So, and his name even means accuser. So that one's easy. Who's okay. The other accuser? This one is harder.
In one way, his wife, but, or
but
the friend.
Follow through the accusers. The first accuser comes at the beginning of the trial. The second accuser comes at the end of the trial, reinforcing what the first accuser said. So who comes at the end of the trial to accuse Job?
At what? The end, God is the one who's asking him, well, where were you when I was doing
it? No, but this is not God. God is in a different position. He's not the accuser.
God is the second one on trial.
The second one is Elihu.
Elihu, okay.
The young upstart.
Oh, the young one, okay.
That's what Rachel came to conclude. Now, there are two defendants. Who are the two defendants in the trial?
Well, there are, but Job and
God. Ultimately, God is the one who Satan is accusing and questioning.
But God is actually doing a defense. That's my take on the divine speeches, is that God is doing a defense of himself because he takes Job through the cosmic conflict. In chapters 38 to 41, through ancient Near Eastern mythopoeic language. And by mythopoeic language, I mean it's poetic language out of the myth that represents where you have a lot of symbolism and you have the darkness is evil, the deep is evil, the light is good, and the, I mean, just going through the chapter 38 is all cosmic conflict language. That's where I take Job. God is on trial in Job because almost directly, the Satan says to God, you have blessed him with all that he has. But if you take out your hand and strike or take away all he has, he will curse you to your face. God is clearly the one on trial. Job is secondary to God in that trial. And that's where both Rachel Magdalene and I came to conclude. And we did it separately, but we ended up using each other's dissertations. It's kind of weird. Katrina, would you read verse 12? I'm sorry, there's only one verse, but we haven't discussed verse 12.
But above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment.
This is also quoting one of the Gospels, isn't it? Who else said, let your yes be yes and your no be no?
Jesus said that.
Yeah.
What was the practice, I mean, of the oaths, and what was the guarding against the swearing of an oath, I guess? What's the context of that?
Let me grab a book. I have a book in my office or my study that says Oath Formulas in Biblical Hebrew. I don't think I've ever read it through, but I've referred to it. So I don't want to look at previous scholarship. It talks about invocation of witnesses. An oath was a legal thing you did, often in a court case. So swearing, may Yahweh be true and faithful witness for us if we do not act in accordance with everything Yahweh, your God, sent you to tell. That's a self-curse kind of oath. May Yahweh, this is Laban to Jacob, may Yahweh keep watch between you and me. If you oppress my daughters, and if you take wives in addition to my daughters, or take wives in addition to them, inference, may you be cursed. That's a curse on someone else. A lot of oaths are curses.
So to me, it sounds like God's just saying, leave me out of this. you make your deals between yourself, but don't pull me down into your squabbles.
Well, you see, by invoking God, you are being a bit boastful, inferring that you can keep your oath.
Jephthah.
So don't even make an oath.
Jephthah made the worst
oath. He made a vow. He made a vow, which he swore by an oath. Yes. So that's
another. The Lord strike me down if I don't thus and so by the end of today.
Exactly. Jezebel makes an oath. May the gods do to me immoral also tomorrow if your life is not as the life of one of them.
So James is promoting keep it simple. Let your yes be yes, your no be no.
No be no.
So yes. When I get sworn in as a president of the United States and I refuse any holy book, and I just say, let my yes be yes and my no be no.
That would send you into a spate of incredible argumentation and dissension and uproar in the United States if you did that.
They do allow that in courtrooms. I have heard that in courtrooms, that you do not have to put your hand on any holy book. Oh. You can simply state, let my yes be yes and my no be no.
Really?
Yes. Yep. Because there is a whole strain within Christianity where they take this to be very serious and very literal, and they refuse to swear by the Bible or swear by anything.
Well, I would like to do that myself if I ever get called into court.
I have determined that myself, and I bring it up because I think you're right. We, on a political basis, it would be very hard not to do that in front of a nation. But on the other hand, if they elected me, I would have to say they would know what they're getting at that point.
Well, I'm not expecting you to run for president.
No, I don't see it either.
The reason that people originally evoked the names of their gods was because they wanted to attest to the seriousness of their words and the commitment they were making. Like today, with setting up to say something, you need to sign that, as if signing it makes it, you know, real, right? There are consequences. And so when they evoke the name of the god, they're signing it. They're saying, right, I'm really going to do this. You know, it can't just be whittled away. There's consequences.
Well, they actually believed the gods would act. So there's a whole history of this. This actually started back in Mesopotamia, probably, or ancient Mesopotamia. But by the Neo-Babylonian period, there was a whole thing, and this goes back to the book of Job, too. Job gives his own defense at the end of the book in chapters 29 to 31. And he gives his own oath of innocence. And an oath of innocence was considered to be equal to another witness. And here's Job's problem. Job has no witnesses on earth. No one will vouch for him as an innocent man. So he goes to God and says, God, you're my witness because you know. But he still needs another witness. So he does his oath of innocence. That was considered to be the equivalent. So, but what happened in the Neo-Babylonian period is that they came to not use the oath of innocence. They used to use it in the old Babylonian periods and previous periods. They used to use the oath of innocence all the time because they believed the gods would act. But by the Neo-Babylonian period, they came to distrust the oath of innocence because the gods didn't seem to act. And so they started using witnesses solely.
So if this is too much of a tangent, then we can ignore it. But I'm just curious, when you were talking about the oath to God and being a second witness, of what made me think of that, thing that was laid out for if a husband accused his wife of infidelity and she says no, but then they go to the temple and she would drink this concoction of dust or whatever, and then, you know, swearing before God that she didn't, and that kind of
she
became the second.
Then
if she didn't get sick or whatever, then that was their second witness, or, you know, anyway, that just kind of came to mind as you were talking.
That's all part of that. In Babylon, all she had to do was to go to the temple and swear by the gods, I did not do this.
Mm-hmm.
I was not unfaithful. But it's more complicated in the Israelite community because there is a second part to Hammurabi's laws. It's in Hammurabi that this law exists. It's a second part to Hammurabi's law where if the companions say to her husband, we know what this woman's been doing, we've been seeing her with different men, then she has to throw herself into the Euphrates River, which is a trial by ordeal. And the Euphrates River had a very strong current. And scholars used to think that they never really practiced that. That was just hot air. And then they found texts that actually told how they did it. And they found a man with his head bashed in downriver because he threw himself into the river, and boy, did the gods take care of him. The river, the Euphrates River, was a god of judgment, by the way. Well, it would be Israel. It would be easy for the Israelite community to transfer that knowledge to, because, by the way, the Book of the Covenant is very Hammurabi. Mm-hmm. It's a take on Hammurabi. It would be very tempting for them to take the Jordan River and make it a god of judgment, and you have to throw yourself into the Jordan River, which in the springtime would kill you.
Right. It casts a whole new light on the Naaman story too.
Yes. Oh, I love to talk about that story. I shouldn't digress, but you pushed the wrong button, Bill.
Sorry. This is another one of those things we could write down on the margins. And when we're done with going book by book, verse by verse, we come back and visit some of these.
Just in a short shift, the reason Naaman was so upset at what Elisha told him to do, which was to dip himself into the Jordan River. He said, don't I have the river such and such in my territory? Why can't I go to them and dip myself in them? They're better judges than Israelite God. The Israelite God doesn't know me. He's not going to judge me, right? And finally, his servant talks him into it. So he goes and dips himself and he comes whole. No more leprosy. What is God saying through that? He turns the river judge into the physician.
From judgment to healing.
River of healing.
Mm-hmm.
River of healing.
Makes the streams that make glad the city of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim Jennings would certainly like that. It certainly fits with his remedy take on things.
There's nothing in the Bible that ever says that the Jordan River was the god of judgment, but that's how Naaman would have seen it. Because all rivers, in fact, there's a name in the Baal epics, it's called Judge River.
Hmm.
All rivers were judges. And it's because of this trial by ordeal.
In the Bible, we have oceans of chaos, but we have rivers of healing that bring life.
Mm-hmm.
But the ocean
do you remember? Yeah, the oceans are evil. They represent the forces of evil. But rivers are springs of life. Do you remember where the Bible says that, Katrina?
There's in Ezekiel, in Ezekiel, I think it's 45 or 48, where it talks about the throne of God and how the streams.
Oh, that's right. The New Jerusalem.
It's for the, and the leaves of the trees are for the healing of the nations. And then Psalm talks about the trees planted by the river. If you are, you know, with God, you be like the tree planted by the river that doesn't cease from yielding, you know, fruit and abundance and health. So this is where you plant yourself.
That's a real transformation. Here Ezekiel's in Babylon writing. And that's a real transformation. Of course, I think he saw that all in vision. I love to find those things. I'm tempted to do a sermon series on it. All those times where God takes something Babylonian and turns it into
New Jerusalem.
New Jerusalem. Yeah, there you go.
It's true. No, God answers the philosophy of the age. And we need to do that today.
Why don't I close with prayer and then we can view our discussion. Let's pray. Gracious Father, we thank you for the ways in which the Bible brings us back to some of the important things that Jesus said and enlightens us in the importance of those things for our lives. May we live by them. May we profit by them. We ask for a special blessing on us this week as we face whatever challenges are ahead of us. In Jesus' name, amen.